Christian Rob McGregor welcome you to a place where all kinds of phenomena flourish. Voices whisper, ancient secrets, signs and symbols are abundant. UFOs, ETs, ghosts, and even the dead move about freely. Here we meet authors, researchers, and investigators of the mysterious, the strange, and of the inexplicable anomalies that surround us. Step out of the everyday world and take a journey into the mystical underground.
Welcome to the Mystical Underground. Thank you for joining us. This is Rob McGregor and
Chris McGregor.
And our producer and fact magician, John Polisi. You can go to themysticalunderground.com where we make regular blog posts and where you can find out about our books. Among them are Phenomena, Harnessing Your Psychic Abilities, The Secrets of Spirit Communication, Sensing the Future, and Aliens in the Backyard. Our latest book is called Mind-Blowing Synchronicities, the Latest Science Stories and Research. Trisha's latest novel, White Crows. Rob's most recent novel is called Pulpas, the story of the mysterious beings created through deep meditation. If you are watching us on YouTube, we would appreciate it if you would take a second to click the like, subscribe, and notification buttons so you never miss an episode. If you prefer to listen to the show, it is available wherever you listen to podcasts. Please subscribe there.
Okay, Mark Anthony is known as the psychic lawyer. I've never met a psychic lawyer, so this is unique for me. He's a fourth-generation psychic medium who communicates with spirits. He's an Oxford-educated attorney licensed to practice law in Florida, Washington, D.C., and before the United States Supreme Court. Mark was named a notable graduate by the Arthur Findlay College of Psychic Science. He was designated Visionary of the Year by Best Holistic Life, Honoree of Spiritual Awakening, International Circle of Honor, Honoree, and he received the OMI Award for Best Psychic Medium. He co-hosts the live stream show, The Psychic in the Dock, on Transformation Network, voted Best Radio Show of the Year 2024 and 2025 by Best Holistic Life. Mark is the author of three best-selling books. His latest, The Afterlife Frequency, has won multiple awards, ranked as one of the top books about faith, and was up for a Pulitzer. His other best-selling books are Never Letting Go and Evidence of Eternity. He's also a VIP executive contributor for Best Holistic Life magazine. Welcome, Mark.
Welcome, Mark.
Well, thank you, Trish. Thank you, Rob. It's great to be here.
Yeah.
And I want everybody who looks at this to see your back wall. It's fascinating.
Yeah. So the title of your first chapter caught our attention, Spiritual Synchronicities. Can you talk about the meaning of that phrase?
Spiritual synchronicity is a concept that I developed to explain a phenomenon that I think everybody has experienced at one point in their life. And I do not believe in coincidences. I believe that everything happens for a reason. And sometimes these things happen because spirits can guide us into a particular place to be at the right time in the right place. That's why in the first chapter of The Afterlife Frequency, Spiritual Synchronicity shows me, I explain how I was put into a situation. And it was because of spirit intervention that got me out of it. And what happened is the book starts in Bangkok, Thailand. And I spent a considerable amount of time in South Asia, in the Far East. And I was at a Buddhist temple attending a lecture. And it was really beautiful because the master, I mean, he was well into his 70s. He had shaved head, wearing the robes. And he was just some of the coolest guys you could ever meet. And it was so uplifting. And I'd been traveling in Asia with my best friend, Billy. We grew up together. We met when we were 11 years old. And we were both raised in the Catholic faith. And he had turned into an atheist. And, of course, I'm a medium. And so our entire life, we had this discussion about, you know, is there an afterlife? And he said, well, I don't believe it, but there's that thing you do that I don't quite get. So I come out of this Buddhist temple and I'm all groovy and, oh, wow, metaphysical. And Billy picks me up and he goes, all right, man, we're going to go have some fun now. We're going to Pat Pong. And I go, Pat Pong? He goes, yeah. And so we had hired a tuk-tuk driver, and a tuk-tuk is like a motorized rickshaw. It's like a motorcycle, and it's got a spot for a couple people in the back, but it's this three-wheeled thing. And they're all over Asia because it's a very affordable means of transportation. So this young guy, he drives us through Bangkok traffic, which is like L.A. on steroids, you know, so crazy. And we get to Pat Pong. Now, Pat Pong is probably the most deviant and evil city in the world, or street of the world. And I say that, you know, kind of sarcastically, but everything and everyone is like for sale there. It's a huge open air market. And there's all sorts of, like, there's sex clubs and there's, you know, but they're selling electronics and clothing and drugs, legal and otherwise. I mean, it was like nothing I'd ever seen. And we're walking along this, and there's this huge open air market that runs down the length of Pat Pong, and there's canopies, and it's already getting dark, and I don't think the place ever closes down. And Billy said, you're going to enjoy this. And I go, please tell me we're not going to some weird sex club thing, you know? And he said, no, man, we're going to a kickboxing match. And so we go to this kickboxing match, and yeah, I'm a real shutterbug, so I've got my camera. And he tells the people, because he spoke Thai, he told them I was a photographer from Time magazine. So they put us right up in front. And I mean, my dad was a boxer in the Navy, and I've always enjoyed, you know, watching martial arts, but I've never seen anything like this. This was blood sport. I mean, these Thai guys, jeez, they had it. I mean, talk about mixed martial arts. They're kicking and fighting, blood splattering and all this. And I mean, it was really intense. I mean, the photographs I got were amazing. And then on the halftime, this guy goes into the ring with a cobra. And there's he throws his cobra, and the cobra's up trying to strike on me, smacking it and all this. And I'm like, you know, and I got, hold on. I'll show you. Hold on.
A cobra.
Here is one of the pictures.
Oh, my God.
I took. Okay. So this was the halftime. The intermission break is this guy fighting a king cobra. Wow. And it's striking at him and all this. So after a while, I said, you know, Billy, this is cool and all, but I've kind of had enough. And he said, no problem. He goes, I'll meet you back at the hotel. We were staying at the Sheraton, beautiful hotel along the river in Bangkok. So I walk out in the street, and there's these two Australian guys that are having an argument. And there are these big bruiser guys, and they're yelling back and forth. And, you know, I'll maintain G-rated language, but you can imagine. And there was a small Thai woman in between them, and they were screaming and yelling at each other. And one Australian takes a swing at the other one just as the Thai woman breaks in between. She goes, no, no, no. And he connects with the Thai woman, and she goes down.
Oh, God.
Now, the Thai people couldn't care less if two Farang, that's what they call foreigners, Farang, beat each other to death. But when one of them laid a hand on the Thai woman and the other one says, you bleeding blank, 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 you hit my blanker. Okay, so she was a lady for hire. And she goes down, and all of a sudden, all these Thai men jump on the Australians, and these guys are fighting back. This riot starts. And the crowd closes in between around us. And I realized there's only three white people here. It's the two Australians and me. And now the police are running in, and they've all got automatic weapons. And I'm an attorney, and I know very well that there is no right to counsel, right to public defender, no innocent until proven guilty. And they're going to arrest every white person there, which is the two Australians and me. And all of a sudden, I remember seeing the spirit of my Aunt Marjorie, and I never met my Aunt Marjorie in this world, And we can talk about her in a bit if you'd like. But whenever I see her, it's like she always warns me of danger. And I remember, like, there was no way I could get out of there. And I started, like, praying. I said, God, I need a miracle, and I need it right now. I mean, I was, like, because I knew what was about to happen. You know, getting pulled to a Thai prison was not, you know, something that should happen to anybody. And all of a sudden, right up in front of me, this little kid appears. And he goes, Charlie, you come with me now. And that's what they call Americans is Charlie. And he grabs me by the hand and he pulls me towards this table that was part of the outdoor market. And so we're on our hands and knees and people are kicking me and calling me all kinds of names, like, you know, kill him, the dirty Farang and all this. So we're climbing underneath this whole set of tables. It was about 50 feet long and there's broken glass. You know, I've got shards of glass in my hands. And he had this piece of junk tuk-tuk at the far end. And he goes, you pay now. And I remember what it is, this kid saw an opportunity and he took it. And I was real happy. And I pulled out a $100 bill. And his eyes got so big because that's more money than the average Thai made in a year at the time. And I said, kid, get me out of here. So he goes, we go now, Charlie. You know, so I jump in the back, cranks this thing up, and the police are like, get that one, get it. So the cops are running towards us, and he cranks this thing up and just goes right into the crowd, almost hits a cop. And we go zooming down Pat Pong out under the main drag in Thailand, all right, and in Bangkok. And I'm sitting here like breaking out in a sweat, like, oh my God. So I get back to our hotel and I took a shower and I'm picking the glass out of my hands. I'm sitting there on my bed and all of a sudden the door comes in and there's Billy and he's obviously had a couple of drinks. He goes, dude, it's really good you left when you did. There was like some riot out in front of there. So I explained to him what happened. And I remember he said, wow, man. First, you're like this psychic lawyer. Now you're like, what, Indiana Jones in court round? You know, and I'm laughing. Yeah. It's like, I, you know, I can't make this stuff up.
I was about to say, by the way, Rob, this sounds like a chapter out of an Indiana Jones.
Yeah, it does.
Oh, my God.
Yeah, with the little kid.
Yeah.
coming to the rescue.
It really was. And, I mean, I couldn't believe it was happening. And Billy always surprised me because what he said, so you think that kid was there for you, huh? He goes, did it ever occur to you that you may have been there for him? You gave him enough money to feed his family for a year. Wow. And he started talking about Carl Jung and the concept of synchronicity.
Mm-hmm.
And he said, that kid saw an opportunity and he took it. And I said, but what about the Australians? He goes, well, they're probably sitting in a jail cell and you could be sitting there right next to them. But that wasn't what was supposed to happen. And it was really amazing how the atheist who didn't believe in spirituality, he planted that seed. And so when I was writing the Afterlife Frequency, that came to me that I needed to use that story to illustrate how spirits can guide us at the right place and the right time. And my Aunt Marjorie showed up at the right time and all of a sudden that kid. So
yeah,
that's what I mean by spiritual synchronicity. All right.
That's a great story.
That is a great story.
Yeah, let's go back to your youth and growing up. I mean, your parents were mediums, right? And
was that like?
Well, it was really a bummer being a teenager when your parents like knew stuff. Like I couldn't
they
get
were
away
supposed
with
to
anything.
Know.
Well, you know, teenage boys, you know, we're always, you know, we're always up to something. It's not necessarily bad, but the thing is my parents, it was such a privilege and an honor to be their son. And I'm the first person in the family to go public with this. My dad was one of the original Navy SEALs. And then after the Navy, he became a NASA, an aerospace engineer. So he was a real no-nonsense kind of guy, but he could see spirits. And my mother was a commercial illustrator and artist, and she was a bit more open. She would talk about her abilities, where Dad was like, you know, he didn't want to talk about it outside of the house. And I tracked these abilities on both sides of the family back into the 1890s. So that's why I say I'm a fourth generation psychic medium, although it is logical to assume that this goes back even further, because from what we can tell, and by we, I mean those of us who study psychic ability, and because I'm a psychic medium, but I'm also a survival of consciousness afterlife researcher, a near-death experience researcher, and a near-death experiencer, a paranormal investigator, and I study ancient mysteries. And this appears to be a genetic trait that runs in my family. So when you get two parents that have the same genetic trait, it increases the likelihood one of their children will have that ability, and that child happened to be me.
Are you the only sibling?
I have an older brother and an older sister, and they're very precognitive. Like they'll anticipate things before they happen, but they're not mediums. It appears that I got the whole package.
What happened to you? What happened to you at age four?
His NDE.
Yeah, I don't want to go too heavily into my NDE, and the reason for that is it's so crucial to my book, The Afterlife Frequency. But I will tell you this. I was 4 years old. See, I'd already started seeing spirits when I was around 3.5. And my dad, you know, working in aerospace, he was always on business trips, and he was away, and we were living in Orlando. I was born in North New Jersey, but my dad got a job in aerospace, so we had to move to the Orlando area. Mm-hmm. So, you know, everything that was happening with the space program. And there was an epidemic going through our community of impetigo. And I caught it. My siblings caught it, but they had a mild version. And the doctor said, well, just put them in a bath with some, you know, bleach, you know, for the rashes and all this. But what the doctor didn't realize is how bad I had the infection. And all of a sudden, I went from just impetigo to developing septicemia, which is a blood infection. And all of a sudden, and I remember being in the bathtub because I could smell the chlorine, and I stopped breathing. And my mother freaked out, and obviously, and she pulled me up and out of the bathtub, and she ran outside. And my brother had run across the street because there was a fireman that lived across the street, and he saw that his car was there, that he was home. Fireman Rory, I remember that's what we called him. His first name was Rory. Meanwhile, my sister, who was probably 14, she had called an ambulance, and so the fireman ran across the street. And I remember my mother was screaming, "My baby's dying!" And the fireman ran across the street, and he started doing CPR on me, and he got me breathing. So the ambulance arrives, and they put me on a gurney. They get me in the ambulance. Mom jumps in the ambulance with them. They slam the door. They take off. So what happened, though, was they put a oxygen mask on me, but the oxygen hose got caught in the ambulance door, and it cut off my oxygen supply, and I flatlined, and I went into cardiopulmonary failure. And all of a sudden, the next thing I knew, I shot through the roof of the ambulance, and I'm hovering above it as I'm seeing it heading down Orange Blossom Trail. And all I could think was, why are there numbers on the top of the ambulance? You know, I didn't know at the time. I was four. Yeah. And that's, you know, that's for helicopters so they can spot it and all that. And if you want to find out what happens, you're going to have to read my book, The Afterlife Frequency.
Now, Mark, do you remember all that? It sounds like you do.
Oh, yeah.
Interesting.
I remember being about 18 months old. I remember, you know, my first vivid memory is really amazing. I remember I was sitting in a high chair. And I was banging on the high chair, you know, down on the tray in front of me. And my parents, my mom and my dad, they were like bent over like this, talking to me, telling me how much they loved me.
Huh.
That's my first memory.
What a great memory.
I mean, yeah, I think about that because I talk to some people and they say, well, I can't remember anything before age five. But my parents told me that not long after that, I went from mama and dada to full sentences within 2 weeks. And then dad said, and then the questions, why is this? Why is that? How does this happen? Why? And he said, and the questions never stopped. So I was very fortunate because dad liked to explain things, you know, and being a, you know, a science guy. And my mother, they were really good with me. And like I said, I feel very, very privileged that I had parents that they understood me. They got it. Because a lot of my colleagues that are mediums, I mean, I hear the horror stories from their childhood. Oh, you're doing the work of the devil and all that, you know, primitive nonsense. So anyway, so I hope that answers the question.
Yeah, right.
Yeah, that's fascinating.
So I think one of the most fascinating stories you have in the book are about the hotshot firefighters and a shared near-death experience. I had never heard of shared near-death experiences before.
Shared death experiences, yes.
Can you go into that one? Because that is an incredible story.
Yeah, the shared death experiences, in my book, I developed the electromagnetic soul theory, which provides the scientific basis for all forms of spiritual contact, mediumship, out-of-body experiences, near-death experiences, shared death experiences, reincarnation. And that's one of the reasons the afterlife frequency has been endorsed by as many scientists as it has, is because it does provide a logical explanation for these phenomena. And one of the most amazing incidents of we all hear about a near-death experience where somebody dies and their soul leaves their body. And in a near-death experience, what happens is, like it did with me, is you leave your body, your consciousness, the who and what you are, leaves your body, and you have what's known as vertical perception. Vertical perception's in like 360 degrees. It's very accurate. Then there's the near-death experiences happen in stages. There's the separation from the body, the floating sensation. You can see and hear what's going on around you. Then there's the sensation of going through a tunnel. In some cultures, it's a path, but essentially it's the same concept, going into a light. And in the light, you will encounter people that you know who have passed. And then if you go to the next stage, you go to encounter the divine energy that, dare I say, is God.
Does everybody get to that next stage?
No, not everybody. That's why there's stages to NDEs. Uh-huh. Think of a near-death experience as here's your body and there's a rubber band, and you get so far, and then wham, then you come back. Whereas people who, the ones I talk to in spirit, the rubber band snaps and they keep going. Huh. Some people just get the free-floating sensation. Others will see loved ones. Okay. Now, the critique of near-death experiences is that it's a side effect of the dying brain, and I spend a good part of the book debunking that theory. Mm-hmm. Also, in the lectures that I'll be giving at the International Association for Near-Death Studies 50th Convention this year in August, I'll be discussing that as well. And so because people say it's subjective, that makes it not true. But a shared death experience is when more than one person experiences the same phenomenon. And we see this in deathbed visions when people who are transitioning and they start talking to people they know who died and people in close proximity. And it doesn't have to be just family members or friends. Mm-hmm. Hospice workers, medical personnel will start seeing them too. Okay. And there's reasons for that. It's a frequency overlap. But one of the most incredible, amazing examples of a shared death experience was the hotshots. Now, hotshots are specially trained firefighters. They're the special forces of firefighters. And hotshot teams, there are about a dozen men and women now who will be brought to really, really intense situations. Like recently with the fires in L.A. that were at, you know, they'll bring the hotshots. And this one team of hotshots was brought to a mountain fire. And the problem with mountains is that wind and weather conditions change really quickly. Also, when there's a fire, fires, of course, need oxygen, so they start creating a vortex that sucks in the wind, and they create this major wind. Mm-hmm. So there was about a dozen of the hotshots, and they're on this mountain, and all of a sudden, the wind shifted, and the fire started coming at them, and it was moving like 100 miles an hour. Wow. These mountain fires, and they knew, and these guys, they were so well-trained, they hit the ground, they put protective gear over them. And one of them, he recalls his experience, he felt the oxygen being sucked out of the air. And the next thing he knew, he was hovering above the mountain.
Huh.
And he looked around and he saw all the other hotshots with him. And there was one of them, his name was Jose. And Jose had been born with a deformed foot. And Jose said, "My foot is all right." And all the other hotshots were saying, "Whoa, Jose, man, you don't have a deformed foot." And the next thing this guy knows is he's encountering his great grandfather who passed, and they had a discussion, and he said, "You have to go back." And he said, "Well, I don't want to go back." He goes, "You have to go back." Next thing he knows, he's back in his body, and he said he felt absolutely horrible, like he'd been beat up to all, you know, and he pulls the protective gear, the blanket, the fire resistant blanket. And then he looks up, and all of his fellow firefighters, hotshots, are doing the same thing. And then they all converge together, and then they started talking about it. And they're like, "What just happened?" Okay. So here we have some extremely credible experiencers. And I think this takes it's just a side effect of the dying.
Right.
And I think that torpedoes that argument.
Huh.
Yeah, that's an incredible story.
Well, when you think about it, I mean, NDE studies have really made incredible strides since Raymond Moody.
Yes,
you know, his book was, what, 1971, I think?
74, and then IANS was formed in 1975.
Mm-hmm.
That's why this year is the 50th anniversary of the founding of the International Association for Near Death. Wow.
Huh.
Have you had the pleasure of interviewing Dr. Moody?
No, I'd love to.
Yeah. No,
I was going to ask, you've met him, right?
Oh, yeah, I know him. He endorsed my second book, Evidence of Eternity. He is the nicest man. Dr. Moody is an exceptional human being. He was a child prodigy. I mean, he had his PhD, like, by, I think at the time he was 21. I mean, he's just absolutely brilliant. And he started seeing that for thousands of years, there have been stories of people who died and then they came back to life with these tales of going through a tunnel, seeing a light, deceased loved ones. And these resurrections mystified religious leaders and physicians for thousands of years. So he was the first scientist to apply the scientific method of objective observation to this phenomenon, and he developed the term near-death experience, you know,
right.
A-N-D-E. So 50 years later, we've made tremendous, tremendous strides.
Hmm. Did you tell him about the firebots?
About this
group of firemen who
the hotshots. Oh, Dr. Moody, he knows about that.
Okay.
Oh yeah, we all know about that. Everybody in the near death experience research world, like my friend and colleague Dr. Jeffrey Long, he developed the Near Death Experience Research Foundation, NDERF, which is a sister organization to IANS. And Dr. Long, he's another person you should interview. Fascinating. He does a great interview. Okay. And he hasn't had a near-death experience, but he's an oncologist. And he started seeing things that defied any scientific or medical explanation. People that should have died did die and then came back with these stories. So what he did is he developed the largest database in the world for physicians and experiencers to upload their And what's fascinating is that near-death experiences, there's about 10 different factors where there are similarities. And it doesn't matter on the person's gender, their religious affiliation, whether or not they're atheists. People tend to think, oh, well, near-death experiences have to have a religious background. No, there are reports not only from the U.S. and Europe, but also Central and South America, Africa, all throughout Asia, Iran, even North Korea and communist China. Doctors are adding near-death experiences to this database. So physicians and scientists worldwide have been documenting this phenomenon.
Yeah, I think that hospitals are one place where it's obviously near-death experiences take place. I'm thinking of one story, you've probably heard of it, where I think she was a Latina woman, was left her body during surgery, moved up to the ceiling and then out through the ceiling and was moving around the corridors and saw a tennis shoe, a sneaker.
Oh, yeah.
On a ledge outside of a window.
Her name is Kimberly Clark Sharp, and she's a friend of mine.
Okay. Oh, wow.
Yeah. I met her at the near-death experience, and I remember I was given a lecture one year about the blue sneaker. And then at the next IANS conference, she gave me a blue sneaker. She's
great. That should be on your wall.
I know. It should be.
Yeah, that's an incredible story, how she went looking for that sneaker that the woman...
What happened was, she was a nurse, and so she died on the operating table, and she started floating above it, and she went by the light fixture and said, you know, there's a lot of dust on this. I need to tell the head nurse. And then she goes, oh, no, I'm dead. And then she was hovering, like you said, above the hospital. And it was in a rain gutter where she saw this blue sneaker stuck there. So when she was resuscitated and she was revived, she said this. And so the surgeon said, get two people on the roof right now and see if what she said is true. And they went up there and exactly where she said it was in the rain gutter a blue sneaker wedged in.
You got to hang that blue sneaker on your wall.
Yeah.
But I have a question. As somebody is dying, do they consciously decide not to come back?
That is the $64 billion question, because in near-death experiences, by and large, the people who come back were instructed they had to come back. Other people say they were given a choice. My friend and colleague, Dr. Mary Neal, her story's incredible. Back in 1999, she was kayaking in Chile. She's a real outdoorsman.
Her story, yeah.
Oh, you know the story?
Yeah, I read it somewhere. I remember this. Chile, because of Chile.
Yeah, yeah. Dr. Neal, she and her husband and a group of friends were down there. He, too, is a surgeon. And she's not just a surgeon. She was the head of spinal surgery at USC, University of Southern California. And he decided not to go that day. Long story short, there was a mishap and she got caught under a waterfall and the kayak sank. And because of the torrential downpour from the waterfall, she was trapped underwater for over 30 minutes. It bent her body backwards, cracked her leg, like, you know how your knees bend, it bent them backwards, cracked her knees. And her fellow kayakers were like, they couldn't get near her because of the waterfall. And she said, all of a sudden, she was in this light. And she said there were several beings there. And she said, and it was really cool because, you know, I've had dinner with her a number of times and said, the peace, the love. She said the indescribable love. And she said that she didn't want to come back. And she realized that she had no control that over what was happening and that she did have to come back. She was also informed that her son, Willie, was going to die in a few years. And wow. that experience was part of her journey that she had to share with other people. So meanwhile, back on planet Earth, here she is trapped underwater and the kayak, and she's all mangled. Nobody can get to her. Suddenly her body dislodges and bumps into another kayaker. They pull her to shore. She's blue, not breathing. If they could get her breathing, they're thinking she'll be brain dead, but they start doing CPR and all of a sudden she comes back. Now, they're in the middle of nowhere in a jungle in Chile, and they're on the bank of a river. And so they took another kayak and kind of made a stretcher out of it, stuck her in there, and they go, we don't know where to go. All of a sudden, out of the jungle comes these young Chilean men. They take the kayak. They find a path. So now they're all going on this path to a dirt road. And in the middle of nowhere, there just happens to be an ambulance. That nobody called. It was just there. Okay. Now, all these witnesses are doctors and very credible people. So meanwhile, another kayaker, when this had happened, went downstream a bit and somehow encountered her husband, who in a rented truck just manages to get to the ambulance as they're loading Mary into it. And once again, he's a surgeon, so he does some splints and he's doing stuff to get her stable. These young Chilean men are nowhere to be found. Hmm. Now, the question is, where did they come from? Or better yet, what were they? They appear out of nowhere in the nick of time to carry her through an impenetrable jungle to an ambulance in the middle of a jungle, in the middle of nowhere, the nearest city's miles and miles away. And so Mary was airlifted back to the States, and she suffered severe lung infections, pneumonia, horrible orthopedic injuries, but made a full recovery. And then a few years later, as she was told, her son Willie was killed in a freak accident.
Oh, that was spiritual synchronicity.
Why was this part of her journey?
That is spiritual synchronicity.
Yeah, the whole thing. Yeah, that's amazing.
I'm just curious. Why was the son's death part of her journey? The things you have to experience.
Well, she and I were both speakers at Helping Parents Heal last year, their annual biannual convention. And she's sharing her insights on the afterlife to parents who've lost children. And let me tell you, Mary is brilliant and she's very skeptical. And so I was very, very humbled and honored when she said, I want you to do a reading for me. She goes, because I've never really believed in mediums. So she was visiting the Orlando area, and my manager, Rocky, invited her to stay with her. And she's doing a podcast and she wanted an interview. And I said, all right, well, I'll do a reading after we do the interview. And the morning of the reading, I snap awake at 5 a.m. and I hear a young man's voice say, give the heart-shaped piece of tiger's eye to my mother. I'm like... So I get up, and in the chest behind me, I remember, I don't know how I ever got it, but there's this heart-shaped piece of tiger's eye, and I found it in there. I hadn't touched or even thought about it in years. And when I do readings, spirits will come through, and they give you certain symbols and certain pieces of information. And for example, if a spirit comes through and shows me an emerald, that could mean a piece of jewelry with emeralds in it, but emeralds are the birthstone for the month of May. So that can mean a significant birth, death, anniversary, or event within the month of May. Well, topaz is the birthstone for November, but for some reason, for some years now, I don't get topaz, I get tiger's eye to mean November, okay? Huh. And I'm like, all right, why is that? So I get to where Mary is. And I said, Mary, and I held up the piece of tiger's eye. So this is a heart-shaped piece of tiger's eye. And I explained to her, for some reason, it means November to me. And I heard your son's voice say, give this heart, this tiger's eye heart, to my mother. And she looks me right in the eye and said, his birthday was in November.
Oh, God. That's incredible.
Spiritual synchronicity.
Did it look anything like this?
Yeah, very much so, except it had like the brown and yellow stripes on it.
Right, yeah. This isn't tiger's eye, yeah.
Yeah.
Heart shape, yeah.
Since you're from the Orlando area, you live there, do you know about Casadega?
Oh, yeah.
Okay.
Yeah.
You belong there.
Well,
I
visited there a couple of times. Casadega and Lilydale in upper state New York are, I don't like to use the word remnants, but let's call them survivors, ongoing communities left over from the age of spiritualism.
Right.
Which flourished in the Victorian era. And spiritual communities, and now there's spiritualist churches, and spiritualism is alive and well. And Casadega was founded back, yeah, I believe, in the 1890s. Yeah. It's been inhabited by psychics and mediums. I understand about 25 years ago, the Wiccans moved in as well. And so
there's conflict from the ones inside the camp and then just across the
outside
street,
the camp
across the street. Yeah. Right. There's tension between the way it's funny when you go there, you know, on one side of the street, there's all these people dressed up like goths and they got pentagrams all over. And the other side of the street, you've got, you know, more of the crystals and you know, the groovy bay. And, you know, I don't have a problem with the Wiccans. And, you know, I get along I try to get along with everybody. And, you know, it's funny. People think, oh, everybody in the metaphysical community gets along. And it's like, you got to realize they are people. And
yeah.
People have their issues and all that. And we need to realize that these gifts, these abilities, it's all about love. Mm-hmm. You know, we do this because evidential mediumship, which is producing pieces of information, things I can't possibly know, transmitted to me by spirits. One of the points of evidential mediumship is to provide proof and evidence of the continuity of life beyond the physical.
Right.
I mean, things have come through that I could not possibly know to guarantee the authenticity of the contact. I mean, anyone can say, oh, your grandmother's here and she loves you. Well, duh, everyone's grandmother loves them, you know, but when you start getting into what she looked like, how she passed, her name, habits, and then when they start talking about things going on with you, you know, personal or physical or medical issue, I mean, these are the types of pieces of evidence to help substantiate the authenticity of the communication.
Yeah,
I think that I had a spiritual synchronicity when my sister died, which was 2 years ago. It was unexpected. She was younger than me. I was supposed to go first, but I didn't. So I'm sitting out in the porch of her house in Marietta, Georgia, with our dog. And I look up, and there is a hummingbird. I kid you not, right in my face, so close I could see its eyes. I said, Mary? And then it flew off. And I realized I had just seen her archetype, that's her archetype for life after death. And so she had a son who was a tattoo artist. So I now have a hummingbird tattoo.
Awesome.
Everybody in the family got one. Yeah. You know, but those kind of things, when they happen, they're shocking and comforting.
That's what I call a frequency beacon.
Mm-hmm.
A frequency beacon, think of like a three-dimensional spider web. And everyone that you love, both on planet Earth or in spirit, connected by spider web. Now, how do spider webs work? They work through vibration. And so when you're thinking about or grieving your sister, you're sending a vibration. Her spirit picks up on that, and it will draw her to you. But frequency beacons are a two-way street. So she can maneuver something like a hummingbird in her field of vision. And the first thing you think of is your sister. That's how you know it's a frequency beacon. Okay. Uh-huh. And then that prompted you to get the tattoo. And for the benefit of not just you two, but all the listeners, you know, have you ever been driving in your car and you're thinking about a loved one, all of a sudden you turn on the radio and there's that song.
Right? Yep.
Okay. Or you find a coin, maybe a penny or a dime or whatever, and as soon as you see it, you think of someone who passed. Do you think that this is just a random occurrence?
No.
And this is the complexity of spiritual synchronicity, which is connected to frequency beacons as well. And this is all part of the apparatus that spirits use to reach out to us and communicate with us. So your example is perfect.
Yeah. Okay, now I know what it is or what it was.
Yeah, we should talk a little bit about your career as a lawyer. How did you get into that, and why, and how does that meld with being a medium? I mean, a medium lawyer is an unusual combination.
It is. As a teenager and a young man, I had been drawn to the clergy, which is not unusual for mediums, because we want to go into a spiritual vein, a spiritual career. But that seemed too limiting, too many rules and regulations. So I switched tracks and went into law, rules and regulations. But but the thing about mediumship and law is both occupations require evidence. Like I was explaining with evidential mediumship, I have to bring forth pieces of evidence to substantiate and guarantee the authenticity of the contact. Now, what does a lawyer have to do to prove your case? You have to have evidence. Both jobs are about helping people. And mediums, by facilitating contact with somebody here with their loved ones in spirit, does it take away all the pain of grief? Well, no, because nothing does, but it can help add perspective and it can take the edge off the grief. Also, it's quite comforting when you realize that your relationship with somebody that meant so much to you did not cease, but rather has gone from one of the physical nature to a spiritual nature. And that's very healing. And lawyers help people. And I know, believe me, I know what people think of lawyers, but when do you go to a lawyer? 99 times out of 100, it's when things are not real good in your life. You've been arrested, you've been sued, or you need to sue somebody, or there's a problem. You know, you need help. And so both jobs are about helping people. And then I got to the point, and that's an interesting story too, and very synchronistic about how I transitioned out of that. But I had a reputation in the legal profession. It was like, this guy's kind of weird, and he knows things about people that he shouldn't. And when I was a young prosecutor, fresh out of law school, and there I was going to save the world. Well, when you're a young prosecutor, they assign you to first appearances. In first appearances, you know, you have to go to the jail, and they bring people in that have been arrested, because when someone's arrested, you know, we still have due process in this country, I think. So they bring people in who've been arrested. They have to be brought in front of a judge within 24 hours. So I'd be there with another prosecutor, and then there'd be the other table, usually staffed by a public defender, and there'd be some private attorneys there for people who had, you know, hired their own counsel. And I'd look at the people before I'd look at the police reports and go, child molester, drug addict, wife beater, thief, this. And my co-counsel's like, they're looking at the reports going, how do you know that? Because, you know, people have been sitting in the drunk tank all night. They're all kind of rough looking, and you know they don't like, you know, waving a sign. And so it kind of got to be this thing, like, before we show Mark the report, let's see if he can guess what they were charged with, you know. There's other stuff in trial and all that, but I got that reputation for that. So people say, well, does that give you an unfair advantage? And the thing is, we all have a skill set. This was part of mine. And yes, I did use it, but I'm no longer practicing law. I am, I was just on a Discovery Channel show called Destinations of the Damned. And they brought me in because there's this abandoned sanatorium / insane asylum where they believe there was a murder-suicide, and they wanted to see what I would get. And what I picked up was that it was a double homicide made to look like a murder-suicide. And the interesting thing is, after the fact, when we're discussing this, the evidence seems to support my theory a lot more than the official story.
Interesting.
Oh, and I need to put in my pop culture reference real quick. And I'm pretty sure I've brought up this series before, but anybody that's never watched Pushing Daisies, it's a TV series from back in 2007, 2008. And it's about a guy that can bring that gets hooked up with a detective because he can bring people back to life for a period of time and find out what happened to them, and was helping the detective solve the cases. But go check out Pushing Daisies. It's an awesome freaking show. But
I never heard of it. No, it's interesting.
How'd we miss that one, Rob?
So you're also known as a psychic explorer. What kind of explorations have you been involved in?
Oh, my goodness. A lot. I'm interested in so many different things. Certainly law, psychology, biology, physics, chemistry, astronomy, astrology, archaeology, and my passion has been visiting ancient ruins, mystical sites around the world. When I was in Peru, I went to Machu Picchu. Now, for everybody that likes adventure, put that on your bucket list. And it's not easy going because it's at an 11,000 foot elevation. And, you know, I live in Florida, a whopping 9 feet above sea level. So here I am at Machu Picchu. My lungs are like starving for, you know, this rare commodity known as air. And the place is just amazing. It's literally the lost city of the Incas. And there's this one altar, which has been referred to as like where they can conducted, they meaning the Incas, conducted human sacrifice. Mm-hmm. And it's kind of perched on the edge of a cliff, and there's some structures around it. So I wanted to get a really good picture. And there's this one structure, and I went to it. It's this hut, and it's a stone building. And I got my camera there, and I'm zeroing in on it. And all of a sudden, I get this flash of light, and I could see all these people dressed in feathers and these ornate animal headdresses leading right up to it. And all of a sudden I realized I was feeling that I was this young woman who was about to be led there for the sacrifice, and what a tremendous honor it was. And then it ended. And I'm like, whoa. Okay. Now I'm used to weird stuff happening to me, but this one kind of took the cake that day. And I remember I had to go sit down, and what I experienced is what's known as psychometry. Mm-hmm. And psychometry is where you discern information from the vibrational energy of a person, place, or thing. And that's the main difference between psychic and mediumistic ability. A psychic reading is where you tune into the energy of a person, place, or thing and discern things going on with that person, potentially future events. Mediumship is where you tune into the energy of a third party, meaning a spirit. So what had happened was I picked up for just a few seconds on the residual energy echo of what had happened there over 5 centuries ago. And it was really fascinating and kind of overwhelming. I've experienced similar phenomenon at Dachau concentration camp in Germany, which was really intense. At a site in Hawaii, certainly at Ground Zero 9/11, of course, with Discovery Channel, and then several other sites at places I've been to around the world.
There's another place in Peru you should go to. It's called Marcahuasi. It's at 14,000 feet. There's nothing there on the top. You have to either go by burro or donkey or helicopter. And there, all the rocks there are shaped like animals, and nobody knows how they got there.
Whether they're carved or natural, it's
A friend of ours wrote a book about Mark Awasi. But that's the kind of place where you, as a medium, would probably have a field day.
Peru was just incredible.
Yeah, Peru's great.
Peru in many ways is as mysterious as Egypt. And the funny thing is, you know, I do so much work with Egyptology and ancient mysteries in Egypt, and I've yet to be there. And people are like, why haven't you been to Egypt? And the thing is, every time I plan a trip to Egypt, something happens to prevent me from going.
That's interesting.
It is real interesting. So I figure when I plan one and then nothing blocks me, that's when I'm supposed to go.
Yeah.
Yeah.
You should also go to Ecuador. That's another really fascinating country. Very mystical.
Yeah.
So I hiked the Inca Trail to Machu Picchu back in the 80s and mid-80s. And it was kind of interesting because we got off the train at, I can't remember what kilometer, and I ended up with two Israeli guys and a Lebanese guy. And so we spent a couple of days together, and we finally hiked or camped right above Machu Picchu. And it's quite an experience there right at sunset. But the problem is these guys, the Israelis and the Lebanese, were fighting the Mideast war. And I'm trying to, you know, get into what we're about to witness there. But anyhow, in the morning, just after sunset, we walked down. We didn't have to pay or anything. We're the only ones in the city itself, and it was just an incredible experience. But I almost died though leaving that place because on a train, the train was very crowded. Taking the train back to Cusco, and I had a backpack on my, you know, hooked on me. And I was actually hanging on the outside of the train, and it was so crowded. And then there was somebody yelled, thief, thief. So there was a lot of congestion, some trying to stop this guy from stealing stuff from other people. And I'm hanging on there, and suddenly a hand comes out of nowhere, grabs me and pulls me in, and just that. Seconds later, we go under a tunnel that's very close to the train, and I would have been crushed by that
so
tunnel.
You had your spiritual intervention.
Yeah.
Yeah, spirit intervention is that could have been a human hand. Somebody could have motivated to do that.
Sure.
And sometimes there's people who at the last second say they've been pulled out of the way of something. And people say, I'd like to experience that. It's like, okay, do not test that theory. If it's going to happen, it's going to happen. But you know, always be very mindful where you're at. You know, I'm glad you said, like, with the Israeli and the Lebanese guy. Mm-hmm. See, they were all given an opportunity to put their differences aside and instead revel in the spiritual and mystical place that they were at. And it was their choice to focus on ego, because where they were, that conflict did not exist. Yes, it exists over in the Middle East, but it's time to let that go. And that's the problem with this world. I think Jimi Hendrix, the great guitar rock icon, said, when the power of love overcomes the love of power, we will finally have peace. And he was right about that. You know, Jesus said, love your enemies. And that's a really tall order. Yeah. And Golda Meir said, we will have peace when our enemies realize that they love their children more than they hate us. And so, you know, the Middle Eastern conflict, one of the last interviews I saw Jimmy Carter, he said if he'd been given a second term, and I'm not justifying the Carter administration, I'm just saying what Jimmy said. And I was honored to meet him. He came to my law school, and I actually had a brief conversation with Jimmy Carter. What a nice guy. And he said he wanted to work on the Arab-Israeli conflict. He said, Once he got the Egypt-Israel Camp David Accords, his next objective would have been that. Now, maybe he would have been successful, maybe he wouldn't, but if anybody could have done it, I think it would have been him.
Okay, this I probably shouldn't ask this question, but I'm going to. Do you get any spiritual guidance on what's going on in the United States now?
Oh, yeah.
Are we going to survive this?
Yes. And we're supposed to be going through this right now. Okay. There's a 7 years of discord, and the good part is we're about 3 years into it now.
Okay, 4 years.
Yeah, we have to go through this. And I try to
avoid
political commentary because I believe, one of my favorite celebrities is Steve Martin. And Steve Martin said that he never discusses politics and he never makes political jokes because once you do that, you lose half your audience. And I've got fans, admirers, whatever you want to call people who are interested in my work. I'd rather say that. I don't get into the whole, I get fans. It's like, that's not, not why I'm doing this. On both sides of the aisle. And I'm here to help people understand that life continues beyond the physical as opposed to getting interjecting myself into political discourse.
Yeah, I was just curious about whether you get any guidance on that. A time frame was interesting.
I did get something interesting. Back in 2019, the last quarter of 2019, I was doing readings for several people, and I kept their spirits would come through, and their spirits would all be wearing surgical masks.
Yeah.
Oh boy.
And they kept saying March 2020. So I'm saying to everybody, I go, well, are you in the medical profession? Are you scheduled for surgery? And everyone's like, no. And nobody knew what it meant. Well, then March 2020 rolls around. I start getting emails and calls all over the place. And people say, now we understand what the messages meant. We're all wearing surgical masks because we're in lockdown. And now it's March 2020. And so the spirits were giving us the heads up on that. What I do have a problem with is people that call it the plandemic. And, oh, this was engineered, and I don't believe in science, and blah, blah, blah. It's like, look, and maybe I'm saying something that may be unpopular, but I get my science and my medical advice from doctors and scientists, not from people that hang out in crystal meth labs, okay? so science is a gift from God, I believe, as Nikola Tesla did, that what one person calls God, another calls the laws of physics. I believe that people who have dedicated their lives to studying science and biology and microbiology and chemistry, that we need to listen to them and respect them. People have varying opinions on this. That's their choice. Mm-hmm. So I'll just leave it at that.
Yeah. So people can go to mediums to make contact with the other side, but there's ways for people to develop their, everybody has some psychic abilities and mediumistic abilities. And you mentioned RAFT can you talk about that? Because that's something that I think can help guide people in this direction.
In my book, The Afterlife Frequency, I introduced my RAFT technique. Yeah. RAFT stands for recognize, accept, feel, trust. And I give exercises in the book, and I give stories to support how you can recognize the presence of spirits. Then you have to accept that the contact is real. Feel without overthinking it. Now, that's the hard part. People hit the third step because, you know, they'll get that, like Trish, the sign from the hummingbird. Let's walk you through it. You saw the hummingbird. You recognize the sign from your sister, you accept it as real, you felt it, you didn't overthink it. You could have said, oh, well, this is just a coincidence.
No, I don't believe the coincidence. So.
And then that's where you fizzle out, but you felt it without overthinking it, and then you trusted in the experience.
Yeah.
And so RAFT technique will teach people how to do that.
And it's really about lowering their shields of disbelief, I think,
correct.
People tend to put up when they are confronted with the other side.
Absolutely. People have their deflector shields. It's like on Star Trek. It's like, hey, shields, you know. There is truth to that because you're creating an energetic block. It's like during a reading, I tell people, don't immediately go to no. No, 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 no. It's like, don't do that. Okay. Yeah. Think about when you ask somebody for something, you say no, as opposed to let me think about it. And it's the same thing with spirits. Also, things that spirits bring up may not make sense because they haven't happened yet. Like in the readings where I kept seeing people with masks and they're saying March 2020, and people are like, well, no, that doesn't make sense. How about it doesn't make sense at this time?
Yet.
Mm-hmm. Yeah.
Well, it's funny when that hummingbird thing happened. I knew what it was, and I went tearing into the house, and I said, Mary was here. She's a hummingbird. And everybody said, I want a tattoo. So that's how the whole thing developed.
Yeah.
Well, it's a way of honoring her. And yeah. When you look at the tattoo, what do you think of?
Her.
Mary. Yeah, exactly. Yeah.
And now I've got her two cats.
Yeah. So, Mark, we're coming to the end of our show.
I'd like to invite everyone to visit my website, which is afterlifefrequency.com, just like my latest book, the afterlifefrequency.com. And I invite you to sign up for my newsletter, go to my calendar of events. I'm going to be on a whole U.S. tour, plus I do a number of events online, including spirit communication and light circles, which are limited to 6 people. So everyone is guaranteed a connection with their loved ones in spirit. And every Thursday at 7 p.m. Eastern, 4 p.m. Pacific, I co-host The Psychic in the Dock. And people call in, and I do readings for them in conjunction with my co-host, Dr. Pat Basile, world-renowned behavioral psychologist.
Yeah.
He helps you understand what the readings are, so you can find out about all of that at afterlifefrequency.com.
I've listened to your podcast, several of them, and it's very interesting. People calling in, you get good hits on them often, and she has some good comments still. It's very fascinating that
way we started this show. I was on tour and I was in Seattle, and she hosts the Dr. Pat Show, which she still does. It's won a number of awards, and I was in the studio, and we had a woman call in. Her son had passed. I made a connection for her with her son, and her son basically told her, don't do it. Don't kill yourself. And she started crying, and she was contemplating taking her own life. And then Dr. Pat chimed in, and the two of us literally talked her off the ledge. Dr. Pat got her in touch with the suicide prevention hotline. And when the show was done, we sat down, my manager, Rocky, and I, we sat down, we were having a cup of tea, and Dr. Pat said, we need to do something. She goes, that was really something. And then right after that, the pandemic hit, and then Dr. Pat contacted us and said, I have an idea. And
that's great.
Yeah, and now we're like 4 years into it, and we won Best Radio Show 2 years
ago. Wow.
So I'm very honored for that.
Great. Yeah, I enjoy listening to them.
Has she had an NDE?
Dr. Pat?
Uh-huh.
I do not believe that she has. My manager, Rocky, has, actually. Yeah, she was on an operating table a couple years ago, and she went into pulmonary failure. And she said all of a sudden she was walking through this garden, and she goes, oh, this can't be a near-death experience because Mark always talks about this. And then she said, wait a second, why am I in this garden? Thanks. Yeah.
Okay. Thanks so much.
Yeah. All right, thank you.
And
thank
I'll
you.
Send you all the right. link when it comes all out.
Right. All right, God bless. Have a great night.
Appreciate it.
Yeah. All right. Yeah, bye now.
Thanks for joining The Mystical Underground. Visit www.themysticalunderground.com for the latest blog post and book info. Subscribe to the podcast on Apple Podcasts, Spotify, Stitcher, Google Podcasts, or your favorite podcast app. Listen to the podcast at podcast.themysticalunderground.com. Follow Trish and Rob on Instagram at Trish and Rob McGregor. Follow us on Twitter at The Mystic Cast. Send email to podcast@themysticalunderground.com. And until next week, thank you for listening and stay mystical.